Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I trust everybody has had an interesting and inspiring and intellectually stimulating week, and that nobody has been troubled by two 12-year-old girls dressed as police officers coming to their door and trying to gain entry to their house, because I hear there are some people that have had a bit of trouble with that this week, which is a bit of a shame. So I would like to, we've got a slightly different panel today, because Richard is canoodling with brasses.
Lady. So
he's the ladies, he's with the ladies, he's with the vulnerable narcissistic ladies today. So we have, of course, the usual, we have Mr. Lipton Matthews there, we have Dr. Paul Taylor, Reads of the Lost Art, and we have Alexander Adams, who is an artist who I have interviewed on here before, so some of you may remember that. So great, so cheers everybody, cheers Alexander, cheers Lipton, cheers Paul, cheers
Fred,
yep, so Hergen Gulligan, Capis, Salu, Saludo, Proust, Prost,
Scrubbianan,
yes, and anything else, Skoll,
Nazrovia,
Nazrovia, and Slanger, and Slangervar. And hello, Neil Murray. How are you doing? Hello, John Smith. Cheers. Cheers, Legalista. Cheers, Fresh Toast. Cheers, Little Milky. Salut. Cheers, Resident Poet. Resident Poet has done a very good poem for today, and something else very amusing as well. So we'll read that out in the interim. And cheers, Tarantism and Michael Smith and everybody else. Cheers, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which we discuss based science, based art, based anything that is no longer dealt with at our woke joke universities and indeed art schools.
Ed, did you just have a stroke?
No, I don't. I don't think so. No, I think I'm okay. Why did it
sounded like you?
Well, maybe my son is using the computer upstairs and using all the bandwidth, and maybe that caused me to have a stroke. Due to my son using all the bandwidth, causing elevated blood pressure in me. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. If you are a doctor out there and you think I had a stroke, please write in and tell me what I should do about it. But currently, yeah, you can see that I've got the thing on the screen, Paul. The little thing with the there it is. Look, it's he's using the bandwidth. He's using. That's the thing with having a son. I don't know if anyone else here has a son. But
have you tried tasering him?
I was just about to say that. Where's your brain then if your son is using your head?
All right, but that's very, thank you. That's very good. That is. By the way, Lipton, I want to leave this interview up. All right, I don't want to have to take this down. So please don't mention race or black people at any point during this.
So did you take on the last interview?
Yeah, I had to because you said something that was so naughty. So don't say anything bad about your own kind. Here today, all right.
Sorry, Xander. Can I introduce Lipton? He's the resident racist on the panel.
He's very racist, and it's sometimes he's nice. He's a nice chap. He's a good guy, but sometimes it's embarrassing. And there's certain areas of London, like Brixton or whatever, that I'd love to take him to, but I can't because I just don't know what he'll say, and I don't want to get into a situation. So I can't take Lipton to. For example, the area of Birmingham where UB40 come from, Handsworth, because what might he say? Anyway, so cheers, everybody, and cheers, anybody watching in Handsworth, in Birmingham. Hello, particularly Kanisha, who I met there, who's very good at singing. Right, it's been a bit of a bollocks of a few days, as far as I can see. And one of the things that's weird is that when you live in a society that's so crazy, that something is put on Twitter that you really think might be a hoax. And seems like it might be a hoax. And people say, yeah, this is a hoax, isn't it? This is set up. It's set up, surely. It's set up. These two girls are like 12 years old. And there's no way that could happen. And it's insane. And then West Midlands police admit that, no, this happened in Walsall on the 13th of September. And it's not a hoax. They have edited the video, sure. But it's not a hoax. And I literally did a live stream about it in which I said, well, it could be a hoax. Not a hoax. What did you think about this, Alexander?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised. You know, there's that cliche about policemen looking younger every year as you get older. And certainly these police persons looked, they didn't look old enough to be doing what they were apparently doing. So, yeah, I was a little bit alarmed by that. I'm not sure if I would have taken them very seriously if they'd knocked on my door. But then I think if they'd been older and gruffer, I still wouldn't have taken them very seriously for what they were saying. But bit of a surprise. I wouldn't want that turning up on my doorstep.
We're wondering if you could possibly increase your volume somehow, Alexander. You're quite quiet.
Yes, I can speak a bit louder. I can be a bit more assertive if that helps.
Yeah. Do that. Do that.
I found it a little bit alarming. I don't know how seriously I would have taken it, but apparently it's a real thing.
It is a real thing. They were too young, though, weren't they? Too young, Lipton. I think they were too young.
Well, when I saw the video on Twitter, I read the note saying that it was a hoax. I didn't bother to research it. But yes, it looked really young, like around 15, 14. And it didn't sound serious.
No, and they shouldn't be allowed. If that is the case, they shouldn't be allowed. The West Midlands Police should not employ schoolgirls to go around entering people's property. I mean, I think it's asking for trouble. It's like they shouldn't have. I thought child labour was illegal. I thought you had to be at least 16 in England to get a job.
I know it's against the spirit of this channel, but can I add some new ones?
All right.
I think there's been a press release by the local constabulary, and I divide it into two parts. According to people like the Black Belt Barrister, they do seem to have not followed the criminal evidence procedures for entering the house. So procedurally, they look like they're completely out of kilter. But the reason why they wanted the phone, it may be much more significant than just the person viewed something inappropriate. It seems to be, one of the rumours at least, is that they were using it as a troll account and they had taken over someone else's identity. So on the one hand, I think there's more justification for the police to speak than people might suppose. Let's see how it all plays out. This is all speculation, but it does seem that they went into the house, again, with the caveat, you don't quite know how the video was edited, but it seems like they didn't follow, I think it's Section 17 of the Criminal Evidence Act.
Yes, this is the impression I, again, from Black Belt Barrister. And he, I don't know if you've seen his latest video, but he's now taken on that the mother's case pro bono. So he's going to act as her defence or sue on her behalf or something along those lines. But yes, it does seem that there are there's been a lot of discussion on Twitter about this. There are very specific circumstances in which you may enter a property and seize things within that property. And one is that if a crime is literally happening, one is if you suspect a serious crime is about to happen. And one is if you have a warrant from a magistrate, and those are basically the circumstances in which you may enter a property, and you do, and you can just do it if you have in those. So, and obviously that's not the case there, and this was demonstrated by the fact that they talked about being invited to the police station for an interview and all this. They did not have the right, it seems, to enter that property without her consent, and it seems that she felt kind of bamboozled into being into having to let them into the property. But then I suppose on the other hand, if I wanted to take the side of the police, why have they sent two probably raw recruits, very young police officers, and asked them to deal, probably just qualified? And how old were they? They could have been more than 20.
I think that's factually inaccurate. I think one of them was the chief constable.
Yeah, you may be right. I think it's almost certain that the girl in the hijab, and frankly, was it a hijab? Because I've noticed that with Muslims, when they wear that kind of headdress, they don't cover their forehead. And the only people that I've seen that cover their forehead are Sikhs. The women cover their foreheads. And I wondered if she might be a Sikh. But then if she was a Sikh, then normally they're not the women. Normally they're not so religious enough, the women, that they would insist on wearing a headscarf when being police officers.
And so, if they'd have hidden the phone, it would have been a case of hide and seek.
That's very, very good. That did take me. That's big. Alexander's just got that as well. Lipton hasn't got it yet, but it was. Do you want to explain what he did, Lipton? It was quite good. It was a pun. It was hide and seek, like seek as in find some, as look for something, like Etsy in Finnish, and seek as in the religion. So that was very, very good. We're starting, Alexander, the spirit which we go on. Things have changed since you last came on here. The personnel have changed a bit.
Apparently so. Yeah.
They've got darker, both physically and mentally. And so things have altered. Yes, it seems to be the case that they may well have broken the law. And I suppose their counter argument is going to be, we're so young and inexperienced that we didn't know and we didn't understand that and we weren't properly advised. And it's very sad.
Except that never works for the accused. It only works for the police.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. For the accused, they have to have a full knowledge of the law, and ignorance of the law is no defense. I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, Paul, the press release they put out was itself rather misleading, because
We don't know at this stage, do we? That the problem the police obviously have is no one trusts them as far as they can throw them, because even if this was a complete fake and setup, the point is everyone believes it initially, because it doesn't take much. We've seen it happen so many times. So the police are hoisted by their own retard in this case.
They are. They are. I mean, we know, for example, the case recently of the police coming to someone's house, was it in Scotland? I can't remember where it was, and demanding that an American woman who was ill with cancer or something take down a tweet because it had offended somebody. And they came in and demanded that they do that. And so the police have put themselves in a situation where the nature of satire kind of is that it has to be slightly too insane to be believable. Like with Brass Eye, the Brass Eye sort of news flash where Noel Edmonds had killed somebody or something years ago. And at first, people were taken in by this. And they were interviewing, for example, him, what played Boise, I don't know what his name is, John Salas or something, about this as part of the clip. And it was quite believable. And then there was little tells, like they had the female news reporter, but she had a moustache. And it was like 1998 or something. And it was only at that point that I realized, John Chalice, thank you, resident poet. Clive Anderson, yes, that's it. And it was only at that point that I realized it was a spoof, but it was enough that you know. Whereas with a lot of these things that are happening, how can you know it's a spoof? I mean, life is more comedic than art at this stage. What do you think, Alexander? Is life more comedic than art?
We've reached the singularity point where you can't. There's no satire that's strong enough, that's distinct enough to separate it from real life. So I think that you just reach a point where you can't be funny about it anymore. You're just presenting the truth, and the truth is more awful and more hilarious than anything you could invent. And I don't know what I would do if I was a satirist. I think I would give up.
I mean, the only thing that could have made it satirical is if, like, the police officers had entered the house and then they'd taken their clothes off and done a kind of nudie dance. And then maybe I'd believe that it was fake.
In your imagination.
Yeah, Ed, because, yeah. Ed, it's not like we haven't seen policemen twerking at pride marches.
This is a good point. So we've got quite far towards them taking their clothes off and doing a nudie dance, haven't we?
Yes.
So it's not much of a step. Like, if they took their clothes off to do a nudie dance and they had rainbows on their tits, then the nudie dance, I wouldn't believe. I think, no, this must be satire. But if they had rainbows on their tits, then
Ed,
I might. Yeah.
Ed, have you ingested Finnish mushrooms recently?
No, I haven't. No, not recently.
That would be a plausible explanation for how you're talking at the moment.
I don't see why. I'm just giving a hilarious satirical example of
you're
of,
not. You're sharing. You're oversharing your personal.
I'm not
oversharing.
How am I oversharing? I didn't say that I've imagined.
It's obvious to Alexander Lipton and I that you are basically talking about your fantasies directly to camera, and well, I feel for one quite uncomfortable.
Locked in your dark basement.
Are you gonna? Sorry about that, Paul. Are you gonna have to go to the Jolly Heretic HR woman?
Yes.
I don't think we have one. I don't think we used to have a Jolly Heretic HR person, but we had to fire them. It wasn't. It didn't. Well, she had too much work to do. She had far too much work to do all the time, mainly because of Lipton.
No, I was just about to say that I like the British police. They're effeminate and lovely, unlike the aggressive Jamaican police who have guns, real guns.
Oh, sorry, before I forget, I don't mean to interrupt, but I saw footage, I think it's the Daily Mirror. They have footage of the riots in Milan, and you couldn't make this up. There's 6 or 7 big, like, Carabinieri coaches, and the minute the protesters come towards them, 7 coaches reverse. It's like 1940 all over again. It's unbelievable. You give an Italian a uniform, and they play the role.
Good heavens. It would be good if our police were more like the Jamaican police, though, because presumably Lipton, the Jamaican police, they wouldn't take any rubbish. I mean, if you had...
No, not at all.
Well, what would they do in Jamaica if climate protesters were blocking the road? Or what would they,
Jamaican police are not afraid to use their guns. They're not they're aggressive and they will swear. They're not afraid to tell you what you should go and do to your mother. So they intimidate people with their language. It's quite acerbic.
Yeah, I understand there was some case of some British police officer that arrested this guy, and he had two female police officers with him, and he swore at the guy or something, or said something rude about him, and they reported.
I mentioned it last time, Ed. You know, plagiarizing me.
I knew I got it from somewhere. I wasn't saying I thought of this. I knew I got it from somewhere. But no, that's true. So you can see how weakened and pathetic our police force are, really. And how we can't really rely on them, and it does seem to be the idea with the police was always that they are a sufficient physical presence to be a bit intimidating.
Having said that, I think either of those police women could have taken you in a fight.
Well, yeah, but that's just me, and I, as you say, I've
well, they have their uses. I'd have paid good money to see that.
I've recently had stroke.
Ed would have willingly submitted himself. That's the thing. He would have been taken down and been, oh, stop oppressing me. Oh,
why aren't you cuffing me?
I know. Why aren't you cuffing me with your clothes taken off and a rainbow flag on your tits? That's what I'd be saying. And particularly to the Sikh bird, I would like her to keep on her religious headscarf during intercourse. Mm-hmm.
In Jamaicans are politically incorrect. Some years ago, a man went to court. He was accusing a woman of rape, and the judge, I'm going to speak in Jamaican part of the judge, said, woman can't rape man. Woman can't rape man.
Is that how the judge spoke?
Thanks, Lipton. Ed now can't keep the video up.
No, he hasn't said anything specifically J. Philippe Russian-esque. So, as long as he doesn't go,
well, he used the R word.
Said woman and rape.
Oh, you can use that word. That's not banned on here, but they'll just demonetize it, which they will anyway. So that doesn't matter.
All right.
That doesn't matter at all. That doesn't matter at all.
Forgive me for a rare show of empathy to trying to look after your best interests. I'll stop doing that.
That's very kind of you. I do appreciate that. I know it's extraordinarily rare, but normally it's just Paul suggesting how much he hates me and Lipton, and wants us to be in physical and mental pain, and even though he's only just met the guest. He probably already does desire him to be in some degree of pain, and is thinking about how that would be achieved using.
Ed, we're back to your fantasies.
I'm not having any kind of torture fantasy about you and Mr. Adams.
I think you are. It's precisely what you've just started narrating.
You just put that in my head, but I wasn't earlier. It was just a more general thing. Anyway, Paul, is there anything else that has caught your topical news-based satirical eye this week apart from the ladies?
No, that's pretty much about it. It's just the ongoing Charlie Kirk stuff and the inability of people on the left in America to realize the First Amendment distinguishes between the right to speak, but it doesn't protect you from the consequences of being a complete arse.
That's exactly what they were saying in 2020. We can fire you, and quite right too, because you have the right to say pretty much whatever you like. But you can also be fired and persecuted and driven out of your job and have your life completely ruined. And they were saying that gleefully.
Well, also the major difference was the people they were trying to cancel were saying outrageous, terrible, evil things like biological reality exists, whereas the people now being sacked are celebrating the death of a fellow human being.
I can see that point, but isn't that a difference of kind? Within the spirit of this, you should be able to say if we're going to protect free speech, we should protect free speech that is absolutely repugnant.
They are able to say it, but if you're an affiliate TV station, you shouldn't have to use public licensing. You have that at risk while people promote the celebration of death.
But that's exactly the argument they used. They said we can't have these people like my friend Mike McCulloch or various other people. We can't have these people saying what they regarded as inflammatory things. We can't have these people having advertising. We can't have these people making money.
Yeah, but the debate then is about what's inflammatory. And I would suggest there's a qualitative and substantive difference between insisting on biological reality and celebrating the death of someone.
Yes, this is entirely true. I agree with you, but it brings in two issues.
Yeah, so you have to argue the case when a leftist says this is inflammatory.
I'm trying to see it from their perspective, which is difficult, I know, but I'm trying with the old empathy, as you were earlier. I really am trying. And as far as I can see, what we're dealing with us, our side, is a most basic human instinct that the kind of person that takes pleasure in someone's death, in anyone's death, is a horrible, horrible person, and we can't predict how the hell they're going to behave. And there's a degree to which doing that is kind of saying it's okay to kill people that you don't agree with. It's kind of by implication saying that, which is dangerous. And it shows us their state of mind. It's almost like it shows us, Alexander, we'll go on to this in the second half, made a very good point in his book about aposematism and how when left-wing people make themselves ugly, they're saying they feel ugly about themselves. It shows us how ugly they feel about themselves and how ugly they feel about everybody else. And if they feel that everyone else is ugly and disgusting, then there's a step from that to acting on it. And that's dangerous. That's a dangerous. It's like knowing someone is schizophrenic or knowing someone is psychotic, and then not. That's what it's like knowing, because these people are just to think like that. You must have something. You must be disturbed. So I think that's our point. I think their point is almost to see the world in terms of heresy. That there are certain things. It's like doubt, like cursing the Holy Spirit or something. And that our nation will be cursed by the Lord if you go around doing that. So you must be purged from the body politic, as Mary did with the Protestants. They have to burn them or else England's in serious trouble. That's the only way I can see that they think. I'd be interested in other people's thoughts on that.
I made that point last week about the disease. So people on the left, they consider us on the right to be a form of disease that must be eliminated. That's what I said last week. We're a disease to them.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. That we evoke their. There's been some discussion on this. I think Noah Carl, our friend Noah Carl, has looked at this, with regard to the people say, oh, people on the right are higher in disgust than people on the left, but it's much more nuanced. People on the right are high in like visceral physical disgust against activities which are, you know, like seeing a bucket of writhing maggots. That seems to induce higher disgust on the right, but deviating from certain dogmas seems to induce very high disgust on the left.
The Charlie Kirk aspect that interested me was I had a bit of pushback on my channel because I did a video about Charlie Kirk and made some link with Kafka. And the pushback was basically Charlie Kirk, yes, it was terrible that he was killed, but, and it's always the but, he, for example, manipulated his debates, or they accused him of such, you know, banal crimes, inverted commas, which I dispute anyway. But even if they were completely correct, it was this scrambling to find some type of context that would even vaguely mitigate what happened. And that's what I don't get at all.
Well, I suppose it's psychologically, it's extremely difficult to admit that there's some kind of inherent problem with your own side, or with you, even with oneself, and only a certain kind of psychology can cope with that, and that's quite rare. I mean, their initial reaction, for example, was to say, "This person's parent is from Utah, conservative. This person is a Mormon, conservative. This person's parents are Mormons." Conservative, ergo, he's a and he wrote something homophobic on one of the bullets, so ergo, he's a conservative, and that's a complete lie, and that was something that was put out by Jimmy Kimmel, was that his name, the guy whose contract wasn't renewed or who was taken off air.
Yes, Jimmy Kimmel.
Right, and it's a total, utter, egregious lie. Which is just gaslighting people. It's awful.
I think that they know that. I think that in their hearts they know it was one of them that did it, and they're very good at doing the thing that we always say we're always bad at on the. I don't know if you call yourself on the right, but what people say about people on the right is people on the right is too much infighting. On the left, They're never criticizing each other. They're never shooting left. They're never criticizing the person who's on the far extreme. They never do it. The right does it all the time. The right is always weak. The conservatives are always weak. They're always disavowing the people who are further out than them. But the left never do it. They won't disavow their foot soldiers. They won't disavow BLM. They won't disavow Antifa, because they're the street muscle.
But they do disavow Palestine Action and so on.
Kind of more complicated.
Not really. Old age pensioners are being arrested with those signs. They're actively supporting them as being arrested.
No, but I mean, the Labour Party purged itself of what it regarded as anti-Semitic elements and the whole construction under Jeremy Corbyn and the people surrounding
it. How's that worked out with the announcement of the recognition of Palestine?
Exactly.
This is a very good point, and we can see obviously why he's done that. He's done that because he's purged all these people and upset all these people in his own party. And now he's losing support, or may lose support, to these independent Islamists. And so the solution is to recognise Palestine. And
I heard that this was like a 3D chess move, that this was actually opening the door to allowing refugees in. But they could only do it once they'd recognised Palestine as a state and say, well, you know, actually there's an interstate warfare. And so, therefore, we are going to withdraw. We're going to help these people move out, so that it's basically everything the British government does is always just a move to import more foreigners.
David Lammy. He makes a similar point. That's basically what he said, that we're going to accept more students from Palestine.
Careful, Lipton. Don't say anything about David Lammy, because we've agreed.
He's a handsome man.
Thank you. It does seem to be extraordinarily an absurd thing to do, because it's quite obvious what motivates recognizing Palestine, and it's a kick in the teeth to an ally from a sort of realpolitik perspective. An ally that is wealthy, and why would you want to do that? So recognizing Taiwan, why would you do it? How does it help you to recognise Taiwan?
Unless it's all kayfabe, unless Israel is actually kind of chuffed about it, and they're like, well, you know, if you're going to take these guys off our hands, if you're going to clear the area for us, we can start doing our real estate development.
That is a good point. The other thing with regard to Charlie Kirk that I noticed was them having a go at his wife for not blubbering like a child at this event today.
Now, that's horrible.
There was a time in this country, not so long ago, when not crying in public was considered a good thing. When it was, you know, whatever happened to stiff up a lip? Whatever happened to this? I remember when it was the Brexit thing. And it was the last parliament in which the MEPs would be, our MEPs would be there, and the what was it called? Not the Reform Party. What was it called? The Brexit Party. Right. And their lot stood up and were singing "Rule Britannia" or something. And you saw, like, there was a Labour MEP for the Midlands, a man, and he was blubbing like a little girl, and he was being comforted. He was being comforted by female fellow MEPs.
Well, worse example than that, Ed, was that German guy, the chair of the security conference at which J.D. Vance said that Europe's got problems because it's forsaken its values. And he was comforted by a woman. He cried later on stage. And I've always long said that, you know, when we had an empire, we were emotionally constipated. And that's what gave us a fifth of the globe. And since we've become emotionally incontinent, guess what? The country's fallen apart.
Yeah, and at the same time, we've become literally constipated, which just makes us stressed and on edge.
For yourself.
Just sitting on the loo, reading Viz or something, trying to evacuate your bowels, and you just calm. And cranberry juice, I believe, is helpful. Prunes.
That's for thrush. That's for your urinary infection and cranberry juice.
Oh, is it? I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know, Paul. I've never had thrush, unlike you. The list of STDs Paul has had
do you know there's a delivery company? I saw a lorry on the motorway that's called STD Deliveries.
Well, why would you pay for that?
I think that's really clever because it's very effective.
It's stealthy. You don't know you've had the delivery until like a week later.
Like the irony of all this is, Ed doesn't know he's in third stage of syphilis.
No, I don't have many of the symptoms of being in third stage.
Well, you were talking nonsense before, so that's one of the signs.
I don't have any of the physical symptoms of being in the third stage of syphilis. You can see from my face, my skin.
Well, maybe you do, but you can't recognise them because your brain's too addled.
That would certainly be a possibility. I wonder if Richard is busy getting syphilis at this very moment.
I think Richard's immune to syphilis.
Yeah, because it's been thrown
I think Richard is busy spreading antibiotic resistant forms of syphilis. Basically, Richard is sponsored by the sexual equivalent of the Wuhan lab.
Is that true? I suppose there are.
He told me off camera, so I'm not making anything up.
I'm not making it up. No, right. We're very loyal to each other here on the Johnny Heretic. It has to be said. We are loyal. But no, I don't think Richard's doing that. I think he's probably doing something involving.
About as loyal as the Borgias.
Yeah, no, a bit more on them. But I did watch a very interesting documentary the other day about the Habsburgs. Oh, they were asking for trouble, and not just with syphilis. I mean, just inbreeding across.
Yeah, they're ugly.
Ugly, and worse than ugly. Hydrocephalus, and they're just asking for trouble. You've got two branches, a Spanish branch and an Austrian branch, and they're cross-contaminating each other all the time over hundreds of years, and then they end up being insane.
Careful, Ed. You might alienate your constituency, your followers in East Anglia, so be careful what you say.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry about that, people in East Anglia. I was at university with a guy whose surname was not Habsburg, but Hohenzollern. How do you pronounce it?
Oh, Hohenzollern, the German host?
Yeah. With him.
Was he a prince?
Yes, I believe so. Okay. He was studying theology. Or rather, he was doing a theology module, because you could do modules outside your subject if you wanted. And he was the year above me. Hello, if you're watching.
At Aberdeen?
No, Durham. And Durham was where the posh people went. That's where you met members of the royal family and stuff. Like, I remember meeting a Yemeni princess at Durham who was doing Arabic, which I thought was cheating because presumably Arabic was her native language. So he's pissed about Arabic. I also knew a girl at Durham that was half Korean and was doing a degree in Korean. It was just cheating. I'm like, I knew a girl that was doing Persian and her parents were Iranian. I mean, this is ridiculous. So it's just
how many Ed, I know the tism is strong, but how many countries are you going to mention?
Well, I've mentioned three, haven't I?
We're just going to keep going.
But I did know a girl that was just this weird spurg who looked like a mouse at my college, and she was doing a Japanese degree. And I said, "Well, why are you doing a Japanese degree?" Oh, it's just so many symbols. She was the counter argument. She. For tism reasons, for pure tism. I mean, she was pure tism, that girl. If you watch, she was so autistic, she used to get up for breakfast, which only the fucking weirdos that were doing chemistry degrees and stuff, only they got up for breakfast. I mean, did you ever get up for breakfast at university, Paul?
I didn't know what it was.
No, because you were doing a humanities degree like normal people.
And but in Edinburgh, I actually chose Edinburgh because at the time, the last orders in England was 10:30, 10:45. And there were bars in Edinburgh at that time in the 80s, late 80s, that mid 80s, that were open. I found one bar that closed at 2:50. It was my favourite bar.
Yeah, and when I went to university in Aberdeen. Someone come up and say, ring me at 11:30 at night. Ed, should we go for a drink?
Well, we never got up before noon. And if you think of Edinburgh in the winter, I saw less daylight than you do in Finland in January.
If you're going to get up at noon, yeah. I mean, I get up.
Glasgow?
Yeah, Glasgow. Count Lipton.
Yeah, Glasgow is the best place on earth.
Yeah, but it's not in Scotland. It's not in Scotland.
It's in Scotland.
No, it's not. We're talking about Scotland, Lipton. Aberdeen, Edinburgh, in Scotland. Glasgow's not in Scotland.
Glasgow's like some post-apocalyptic, scabby place.
Yeah, Glasgow. I mean, I have been there. It wasn't in, like, I wouldn't say it was like Scotland.
It's great. It's so great. The people are great. It's just so good.
Is it?
It's walkable.
It's walkable. No, it's not. It's huge. I had to get a bus around.
It's really walkable. You don't need a bus to walk in Glasgow.
I had to get the bus from Charlotte Street to the university. There was not even walk that.
Yeah, I walked to the city centre from the university to the city centre. I did that in Glasgow.
Well, that would have taken you about an hour.
No, Ed, Lipton is fit and young, and you are old and degenerate.
No. There's no that.
No, yes. That's factual.
All right, that is factual. Okay, I'm 44, but at least I'm younger than you because you're about 58 or something. So,
but I'm like a virile mountain goat. The amount of walking
I do. You drink heavily every day. You only exercise because the dog begs you, and even then, you don't like it. You know, come on, this is a mountain. I suppose you do look a bit like a goat. Yeah, I'll give you that. But anyway,
a priapic mountain goat. I pride myself on.
I thought Paul was rocking the Gary Glitter look a little bit.
Well, I've been compared to Rolf Harris normally, and Harold Shipman,
and Gerry Adams.
Yeah, is the look I'm going for.
Because Gerry Adams has gone, he's gone white now. He's got a sort of a white Father Christmas beard. And except he doesn't deliver sacks full of presents. He delivers sacks full of bombs. But yeah, that's just Gerry Adams for you. I actually wrote to Gerry Adams and asked him to come on the Jolly Heretic. Never wrote back.
I missed him by 5 minutes. I was doing research at a youth centre in Belfast. And he was due to arrive, but I had to leave to catch the plane back. So I missed the chance to say something rude to him.
That's a tremendous shame. I missed Sanna Marin one time.
I also missed Joe Biden on the main walkway at University of Pennsylvania when he'd just been found out plagiarizing Neil Kinnock. And I'd gone ahead of my friends and they bumped into him.
In many ways, it's a terrible indictment on Neil Kinnock, isn't it? That Joe Biden thought this person is so insignificant that I could just get away with plagiarizing his speech.
But Alexandra and I have learned from him because it was Neil Kinnock who insisted on having books behind his head every time he was filmed.
But
Alexandra's only half invested in this, whereas I've gone full on, so I've won the Neil Kinnock impersonation.
Yeah, those books behind Alexander are very thin. They look like children's books from his local library. Maybe they're poetry books or something. The kind of books that
they're all very expensive art books that I got.
That would be it. That's the good thing actually about having when both my parents were art teachers, is that I had access to pornography as a child and other people didn't. I say pornography. They didn't call it pornography. They called it art books. But what it was books. Don't show porn on my channel, Alexander. Was books teaching, you know, how to draw. And these were books from the 70s. They were black and white. Okay, we're talking the full Judith here. I mean, we're talking not groomed. And I actually have data on this, and they didn't do that in them days. If you were born in the 40s or something, so when my dad was at art school or whatever, they didn't do that. So, and that was quite enjoyable for my friends, and also just quite a lot of art. I mean, quite a lot of art, actually, frankly, that I've seen Alexander do, I've seen of his art, is porn, but obviously it's tasteful, it's presented as it is art, but it's nudie. You know, there's that whole, that's one. There was one I think you sent me. Let me see if I can find it. I don't know where I put it. I put it in this drawer here.
I will take this opportunity to promote my new novel, The Naked Spur, published by Imperium by Exeter House Press. Available at all good bookshops.
Alexander, did you read Noel Carroll when you were a student? The book on art? It's a philosophy of art.
No, I don't remember that one.
Okay.
No. Xander, wouldn't The Naked Arsenal have been a better title?
No. Well, I'm saving that for a future one. It's the Naked Spur. So yes, I get the pun. Yeah.
I can't find the pictures you sent me of nudiness. But I was very grateful. I found this one. I found this. This is a poem. And there's pictures in it. There's a big fold out picture. Oh, is that this one? There's one of them. Fold out picture.
On Dead Mountain has some fold out pictures.
There's a big fold out.
Yeah, there's a couple in there. Yeah.
Okay. Fold out picture. I read that on an aeroplane one time. So we're about halfway through. So those who are new, hello. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We're of course online public house, meets on Mondays at 7 PM UK time, 2 PM New York, which we discuss based science and based research of all kinds, which is increasingly expanded from our woke joke university from a sort of a based and artistic and Jamaican and grumpy perspective. If you're new, would you do me a favor? Would you please subscribe? Yes, that's the word. Subscribe. Could you subscribe on The Jolly Heretic on YouTube? But most help me most violently if you do that. And on my Substack, that's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most base stuff I can't put on YouTube, where I put in-person interviews, of which I have a huge backlog, which is why I have Alexander on here rather than a standard interview, in which I put my vlog, in which I put my blog, in which I put videos I make and films I make. And where if you like what I do, you can support me for about the cost of a pint of beer a month. And then underneath me, we have Mr. Lipton Matthews, and his channel is Lipton Matthews. And he gets all kinds of interesting people on, to interesting interviewees and so on, like Charles Murray and people I could only dream of. So please subscribe there. And then we have Dr. Paul Taylor, which is Readers of the Lost Art, where he does some jolly interesting stuff, for example, on the Philharmonica pub in Liverpool, which is a fascinating place, which I recommend. I once bought Lipton a Guinness there, and he didn't drink it. and it has a highly ornate and baroque gents' loo. So go to the Philharmonic. It's very good.
Sorry to interrupt, Ed, but isn't that where you lost your virginity?
No, that's just where you attacked me. But I lost my virginity about 25 years earlier.
But that wasn't a public toilet.
Well, yeah, obviously. It was a glory hole. Now, if we move on to you don't know what that is, do you? You're too old. Paul Taylor there, so please subscribe over there. And I'm only joking, obviously. No, I'm not joking. Do subscribe. And then above him we have Alexander Adams, who do you have a channel or something we should subscribe to?
Yes, well, people can find me on Substack at alexanderadamsart.substack.com. They can also find me on just alexanderadams.art. That's where they find my art.
So and I have to say, I genuinely, as a person who spent his childhood being dragged around art galleries, almost always modern art galleries, as a person that spent every holiday in Spain, I went to Figueres for Salvador Dali. Yeah. I went to, with my parents, I went to Barcelona for him, what built that ridiculous cathedral that goes up into the sky for ages and eventually you get bored and stop going up and you go back down again. What's his name?
Gaudi,
yeah, screw that. It's a good cathedral, but screw his art. I went to holiday in southern France so we could go around Picasso and Guernica as well. I like Alexander's stuff. It's a bit old-fashioned, but in a kind of revived way, and that's what we're going to talk about in a minute. But before we except he makes clear in his book, if you've read it, that you can't just imitate the past. No. But before we do that, we have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn. And I'm waiting for my WhatsApp to load up. Thank you. Where is it? Oh, my God. Sorry about this, chaps. Mr. Quinn. I don't know where I put Mr. Quinn. Here, Mr. Quinn. Okay, go ahead, shut up. Right. And the following poem. Two coppers arrive at the door. They look about 12, but no more. To comply is a must, but without public trust, a mockery's made of the law. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. And if you enjoyed Mr. Quinn's poem, then please subscribe to Mr. Quinn's YouTube channel, which is probably called The Jolly Heretic Poet, and buy his book of Jolly Heretic Poetry, which is available on Amazon. Mr. Quinn also notes that Dr. Paul Taylor asked for a Kipling joke last week.
Yes, yes, I did.
And Mr. Quinn has, I delegated this responsibility, and Mr. Quinn has come up with the following. Why was everyone scared of Kipling?
Dunno.
I don't know. Because he was ruddy hard.
Whee.
Cheers, Mr. Quinn. Thank you very much for that. Okay.
Can I, now, before we get serious, Ed, can I set you some homework or ask you a question?
All right.
Do you know what personal event in your life you share in common with Katie Hopkins?
Well, I've interviewed Katie Hopkins. So
I know you did. But she's recently appeared on the Rosie O'Donnell. Not Rosie O'Donnell. Who was the fat Rosie woman?
Roseanne
Barr.
Yeah. She appeared on her podcast very recently, and she told a story that is directly relatable to your life experience.
Okay, well, that's my homework, is it, Dr.
Your homework
Taylor?
For next week.
That's my homework, so I need to get at least a 2-1 in that, or a first, preferably. All right, I shall look into that, and let you know next week, chaps. Okay, now in the second half, because Richard is selfishly not here, and also because it just interests me, we're going to change. We're not going to talk about the news. Oh, sorry, we do have a super chat I'd better look at. Mighty Balzac says, "If a Sikh needs a cab, does he perform a Sikh hail?" That is very good, Mr. Balzac. Well done.
Did you say Balzac?
Balzac. Right, like the author, okay. Balzac. French. So, yes, French. He actually used to... Was it that guy? It was him that used to say that every time he has sex, he used to go, "There goes another novel." Yeah, he understood that creativity involves, focusing your sexual energies into something else.
You've written a lot of books, haven't you, Ed?
I've also had more sex than you've had.
You are counting animals.
Naturally, yes. If you make your way through an ant's
nest, that's the only way you'd beat me.
Make your way through an ant's nest, then that's a lot of. But it can be quite tight, and you do have to use lubrication. If we move on to something more sensible and cromulent. And that is our esteemed guest, our alliterative guest, Mr. Alexander Adams, and his book about dissident art, How to Start a Dissident Art Movement. There it is. There you see. And even that is a bit nudie, but it's tastefully done.
Alexander, your name on your image was covering the buttocks of that.
No, I think you'll find that
you can see the top of the cleft.
I could see Ed visibly frustrated.
She is a very muscular female, is the model that Alexander used for that front cover. Very muscular, like Michelle Obama or somebody. Now, Lipton, please don't comment. Now, Alexander, I know I've interviewed you before on this channel about a neo-reactionary art movement. That's not quite right, but you know what I mean. A taking the good things about traditional art and a reviving them or something. So tell us, first of all, what would you say is the problem with contemporary art? Why can't we just be into the old new neurotic realism and have done with it?
Okay, right. Well, you cut off right at the end of your question.
Why can't we just... What's the problem with contemporary art? Why is it...
Can you... I can't hear you.
Well, Paul, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, everyone else can hear me.
Can you mime your question?
So it seems like...
Yeah, you've buggered up the sound again.
It seems like... Just at the moment you asked me a critical question...
Yeah, I'm going to bully Lipton until you can hear me.
Found out what the... Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Moscow so, calling.
No, I've completely lost all sound. Tech, don't make Uber have
tech stuff him. Going on here. Right. I have to bloody.
What we're going to do here? I don't know what we're going to do here.
What are you going to do? You need to. I suggest you can't hear me though, can you?
Typical artist, don't you think?
Absolutely, like incompetent. You bring him on to talk about his art, and then his sound goes out, and he can't hear us, he's gone.
He's going to log back in, I reckon.
That was a waste of time, wasn't it? I mean, you bring the guy on to talk about his book, to plug his book, and then he just his sound goes at the second.
You kept...
Is that? Sorry.
Ed, you kept lowering the tone, so I think you've driven him off.
That's not what it was. I remember that time that I brought this guy Bishop Williamson on, who's since died, and at the exact second I handed it over to him to talk, my internet went out for about 20 minutes. And I came back in and he held them in the palm of his hand for 20 minutes. There was like 1,000 of them or 500 of them watching. No, for God's sake. Hello?
Right. Okay. StreamYard was doing something dirty on me, and I've blocked it or changed it or something.
What I asked you was, what is the problem with contemporary art? Why can't we just be new neurotic realists or whatever we're supposed to be these days?
Ooh. Well, it's tricky. I think that what you need to do is you need to set aside what your assumptions might be about what art is expected, because a lot of these have been inculcated because you've been through university or you've been watching the mass media or you've been reading reviews, art reviews. And so a lot of the things that you've seen have been sort of not, they've been pre-approved. They're useful to the regime. It's token art. It's sort of playing at being vanguard, but it's not really. It's getting to where you are because you meet a quota. And so a lot of that has infected the way we think about art and what is expected from art. So we need to set aside our presuppositions and go back to what really excites us. So forget about the style. So I would say to a lot of people who are not on the left, who are dissidents, who are dissenters, I would say forget about the style of the art. Look to what's really true and really powerful, what really moves you, what's exciting, what tells you something true about the world. So for example, Munch did the Frieze of Life. So he talked about the stages of life, so birth and puberty and sex and jealousy and then suffering and death and loneliness. And he talked about the elemental things, and he painted those things, and that was his entire life's work. And it's incredible. And he went into those he had a slightly Christian framework, but he was tapping into elemental things that were also pre-Christian as well. And it was like, no, jump into it, do something real and powerful. And that's more exciting than thinking about what style, what movement, what institution, you know, how can I play
this? My point is that you like, let's give an example. I mean, I have, to be fair, I haven't been that interested in art for the last 25 years. But when I was...
Me too.
I would say I went to the Turner Prize exhibition in, was it 99? And that was Tracy Emin Unmade Bed, for example, and then pictures of her being raped or whatever. And at least with the Unmade Bed, I thought that was quite interesting. It was quite striking. It was quite thought-provoking.
Yeah. I would say that sort of thing, you can have something provocative and something that's sort of quite unstructured, something that you wouldn't consider conventionally art. But it can be exciting. It can sort of thrust you into a different mindset because you're confronted by real things rather than art, rather than a painting of an unmade bed and a little bit of a story written at the side in a caption. You have the actual thing. You have the actual bed. And it does prompt you to think about elements of your own life and if you've been doing things wisely or unwisely. You know, I think it's quite clear that there are lots of elements of that presentation, because it was a really disheveled bed and it was sort of disgusting and there were used condoms and sort of food wrappers and stuff. And it was sort of really messy, and it was sort of like a good snapshot into her life situation. And I think that she kind of knew that it would revolt people. But that was really effective.
Right. And so one of the things that you get is, and I think you noted the possibility of this problem in your book. I can talk more about poetry. there's a poetry journal called the Society of Classical Poets. And they have a very narrow view of what a poem is. Basically, if a poem doesn't rhyme and doesn't have meter, it's not a poem, and that's the end of that. And isn't one of the risks with this idea that you just get this very narrow kind of forcing us back in time where we just imitate the past and that's a marker. That's almost like we're almost like conservatism signaling, and you just get that in art as well.
Yeah. So you find a lot of people who designate themselves as on the right. They will say, okay, well, we want to. The problem is modernism. Everything bad happened after 1900. So therefore, all art stops at 1900. What was going on in 1900? Oh, Victorian painting. You had the end of the Pre-Raphaelites. You had a lot of naturalistic scenes. So you had lots of women in orchards picking apples. You had sort of farmers. You had sort of some paintings of medieval knights in armor and stuff like that. You had courtly stuff. And fair enough, those might embody some of the values that you want to hold and put forward. But I think that you're picking up what's something that's over 100 years old, and you're saying, oh, that's we've frozen stuff in time. And it's like, well, you know, at the time that was actually pretty progressive vanguard stuff, but in sort of 1880 or stuff. So you've just chosen that your vanguard is going to be 140 years ago rather than much older or sort of much newer.
You're like the Amish of art.
Yeah, exactly. You're saying, like, we're going to have the wheeled buggy, but we're not going to have the telephone. So what? And people talk about, oh, Paris is beautiful. But then, you know, like the Paris that people know is the Paris of Baron Haussmann. It's the reconstructed stuff. It was built off plan. It was built with pre-constructed materials. You would buy your house in Paris on one of these new boulevards that were driven straight through, and you would buy them off plan. You'd choose the fittings. The fittings were literally in a catalogue. So what people see is saying, oh, you know, the beautiful French sense of classical architecture and stuff. No, this is something that was done in 1860, 1870, and a lot of people hated it, and it was like the concrete high rises of its time.
Could I ask a devil's advocate question? Mm-hmm. What about, because you used the analogy of, I've forgotten what pieces of technology you referred to. What did you say about it's like
buggies and
but that presupposes that technology does progress and becomes ever more sophisticated. The counter argument might be it's not necessarily true that art inevitably progresses. So, for example, there are peaks and troughs. Nothing is likely to ever be, in theatre terms, Elizabethan drama of Shakespeare. Tragedy will never excel the heights of Sophocles and company.
Yeah.
So different types of art, and I'd argue things like super flat aesthetic are in some ways the death of visual art.
Yeah, and I would say, yeah, you're absolutely right that... you're buying into the weak fallacy of linear progression or even sort of stepped progression by suggesting that art is going to be evolving and that you necessarily can do more and better, that art becomes more sophisticated and more expressive, more profound, the more you go on. No, not at all. I mean, if you've ever looked at ancient art, some of my favorite art is Assyrian art. It's older even than ancient Greek art, and I love Assyrian art. It's incredibly expressive and beautiful and full of sort of hierarchical poses. It's really worth looking up. And I would say, you know, I love that perhaps more than I love the Greek stuff that came later, and I love that more than I love the modernist stuff that came in 1950.
So does it become a question of the what do we see? And you kind of touched on this a little bit, I think. Obviously, I had to read the book quite quickly because the publisher, unfortunately, he was very busy over the weekend. The idea, ugliness, and you quote Nietzsche and his view on ugliness, and the idea of what ugliness does, and then the idea of what the sublime does. And so is the idea that art should take us towards the sublime, and that modern art doesn't do that. Modern art at best makes us doubt things and question things and feel a bit confused and discombobulated. And at worst, it's just trying to make us, I mean, something, someone in the chat mentioned Damien Hirst earlier. I remember, I think it was the same exhibition as the Tracy Emin thing at the Turner Prize, 1999.
Correct.
He had a rotting cow's head behind a glass screen and all flies buzzing around.
It literally stank.
And then also not just that, but I remember it might have been in 98 at the Royal Academy, and you had Jake and Dinos Chapman, and they have manicures of children with like anuses on their mouths and penises on their heads and God knows what.
Yeah, so that was mannequins that had been sort of combined with sex toys and sex dolls and stuff. Yeah.
Sensation.
So sensation. Yeah, sensation in, what was that? Yeah, 98, 99 in Royal Academy.
Academy.
Yeah, so yeah, but you've got a problem of being of the transgression of ugliness of is being seen as a way of divorcing man from his noble nature. But on the other hand, you know what's I was speaking to someone about drama recently over the weekend. Actually, Simon Roberts, who some of your viewers may know, who's appeared a lot on AA's channels, and we were talking about drama, and we were talking about, well, the problem with a lot of people on the right, especially young people, is they're quite earnest, and what they want to do is something that's quite serious, and they want to make sure that they're not falling into the trap of doing the things that the left does so often and so egregiously. So instead they become quite boring and quite safe and quite stolid. And that's not really going to tell you much. There are certain aspects of human nature and human character that we, who are honest about people, who have a tragic view of humanity as compromised, as sinful, as fallen, in order to talk about those aspects, in order to look at those aspects, you've got to be honest about what they are. So you've got to talk about the problems of degeneracy, the problems of compromise, of failure, of taking drugs. You've got to show this. You've got to show this and not necessarily beat people over the head with morals, but you know, you just say, look, this is what happens when you let yourself, when you let your inhibitions go. This is, but it's also a true thing about who all human beings are, and all great artists talk about that truth. And sometimes that truth is ugly. And a lot of the people on the right who want to get into culture, who feel like it's their duty to sort of step up and push back against the degeneracy, which is actually promoted, which are actually encouraged, they want to do exactly the reverse. They want to say, okay, right, we're going to be quite straight-laced, we're going to be buttoned up. And I'm saying, like, okay, I understand what you're doing. But if you want to tell the truth about human beings, you can't just say, oh, this doesn't exist, we're not going to talk about it. You have to be able to talk about it, but talk about it in an honest way without promoting it.
Right. Someone's mentioning the Nazis in the chat. So you have people like, let's say, Oscar Kokoschka. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Right. And this person was persecuted for not producing a form of art that, as far as I can see, is like cartoonishly boring.
Yeah, because this was actually a subject of a book that was called Blood, Soil, Paint, and it was an examination of part of that book, which is available from Imperium Press. It was a description of the struggle between the conservative Nazis and the modernists. So there actually was a battle. So you had on one side Hitler, who was with the conservatives, who was quite sort of bourgeois. He wanted views of lakes. He wanted, you know, quite conventional allegories and so forth. And then there was a modernist side, which included Goebbels and a couple of other people. And they were actually saying, look, listen, the expressionist guys, these expressionist painters who started in, like, you know, 1905, 1907, they're really, really good. That's really strong stuff. It's really powerful. It's earthy stuff. It's about the Nordic man in nature and human passion, and very much to do with Munch, because they were inspired by Edvard Munch, the Norwegian painter. And there was this tussle in the Nazi party between, well, what sort of art is going to be our official art? And in the end, the romantic, the classical, the rather dull, the rather safe side won. not least because Hitler was sort of backing that side, so that that horse kind of was always going to win. But there was a significant contingent of modernist supporters who were actually right wing. So
Alexander, would Nolde be an example of that?
Yeah, so Nolde was a Emil Nolde was a an
again, artistic attitudes towards internet connection. Nolde.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes. Emil Nolde. He was a German expressionist painter. He was a Nazi supporter. He was actually a really serious figure in the expressionist movement. And he was told basically, you cannot paint. Not only you cannot exhibit, you cannot sell, but you cannot paint. They actually came into his house and checked to see if he had been painting. They were smelling to see if they could smell the oil paint. And so it's brutal because he ended up getting persecuted by the party that he believed in. And they ended up shutting down a whole side of art that could have actually worked for the Nazis, for nationalism.
So what you're saying is that in some ways the Nazis were quite unreasonable.
Really?
Careful, Ed.
Careful,
Alexander. You're really going to upset some of Ed's followers.
Alexander, my turn, Alexander.
Yeah.
Question number one. How should the structure of art appear? And I'm asking this question because I'm a fan of this researcher called George Oosterdijkhoff, and he's interested in the uniqueness of Western civilization and Western art. So what's the difference between Western art and art in other countries? Because some argue that Western art is particularly unique.
Okay, so, well, it's partly to do with form. It's partly to do with the ideas behind it. So you've got the ideas of Plato, you've got the ideas of Christ. You've got a linking between the holy and realism. So when you're describing something in a realistic way, it is seen as praising God. So therefore, there was an inherent drive towards becoming more realistic. So there you have the development of oil paint, and you have the development of naturalism. So in the early Renaissance, by artists like Van Eyck, the Netherlandish painter. So you have a drive towards naturalism because it's seen as being related to good. It's true and it's beautiful and it's good. This was the triangle, the aesthetic triangle that was developed by the schoolmen, by the Christian scholars of the Middle Ages, early Middle Ages. So this is something that informs the way art develops and becomes extremely sophisticated, in some ways over sophisticated. So what you get in some other cultures is you get some art that's really vital and raw. And what happens is later on, it gets so sophisticated that artists like Picasso start saying, listen, Victorian painting, Victorian realism, it's not for me. It's too stuffy. It's too dry. It's too fiddly. I'm going to go to African sculptures. I'm going to go to West African carvings and stuff. And he says, I'll get a real kick out of that. And he brings that into art and develops that into his own style. So sometimes you have Western artists going to other styles specifically because they want something more raw, something more honest, something less polished.
All right, that's question number one. And question number two, you were arguing about conservative people being a bit boring because art is about human emotions and real life. But do we live in a world that's able to manage real conservative art? Let me give a perfect example. Some years ago in Jamaica, there was this nonsensical outrage in relation to the artwork of a European artist. I don't remember if it was from the Renaissance period or earlier, but a European artist typically he painted off a picture of a devil. The devil was black and a white angel was stepping on the devil's neck. And it was during the period of George Floyd. And it created this outrage in Jamaica, which was quite pathetic. And I was saying, look, there are several paintings showing good conquering evil. Sometimes the God is white and the devil is black. Sometimes the color does not matter. But that was a really simple painting. And it proves their point that if conservatives are going to be if conservatives are going to create art, they have to be a bit provocative. And that art, although quite old, is provocative now because of the George Floyd issue and people being emotional. So how can conservative people create art without causing other people to just lose their head?
I think that they should be honest, and they should speak to their own people and think about their own people. And that may actually be different in different cultures. So that may be, you know, different. So that will clearly be different in Jamaica from the way it is in Europe, and quite rightly so. You're going to have a different, you're going to have a different vocabulary, you're going to have a different interest, you're going to have a different set of references. Obviously, there's a lot of overlap and there's a lot of continuity. But you should be able to do things that are surprising and disturbing because, so for example, people have talked about Salvador Dali being a disturbing artist, and he certainly is. I actually wrote an entire book on him. You'll find, if you look up Alexander Adams Salvador Dali, you'll find a book that I wrote about Salvador Dali. And he was, in many senses, an extremely reactionary figure. He had an obsession with Hitler. He supported Franco. He became an ultra conservative after the war. And his art, although I have problems with it, with the Christian art, because it seems to me quite limited in that he's going for spectacle. He doesn't talk about the aspect
the idea, the idea that you look at the crucifixion of Jesus, and the idea of looking at it from above, which nobody else had done. I don't think anyone else had ever thought of that. Like you have all these crucifixes at his schools, Catholic in Spain, whatever, and the idea of looking at it from above. What does it look like from the bird's eye view? And apparently, of course, there were birds that landed on the crosses of the other convicts and pecked out their eyes or whatever. That was such a clever thing to do.
It's a remarkable thing. And I was saying, like, even though I've got doubts about some of his theological fixations, because he wasn't actually a very good Christian. He wasn't a practicing Christian, but he came up with, whether you like it or not, he came up with some of the greatest devotional images of the 20th century and perhaps of all time. Some of them are the most original, most powerful. There are some terrible ones.
As you said in the book, if he hadn't been held back, if he had been held back by the surrealists, he wouldn't have been able to do that. So this raises another issue, which is almost like the funding of art. These people were probably getting money from trade unionists or I don't know what, like left-wing movements. I've no idea.
Let's talk about, so Salvador Dali broke away from the communists. He was because he was genuinely weird. He was a real dissident. He wanted to talk about things that were so obscene that the surrealists said, whoa, and they were kind of like revolutionary. They were transgressive, and they were like, whoa, okay, that's a bit too much for us. Hang on, Salvador. So in the end, actually, and he broke over issues of supporting Franco, and so that was essentially the big cause. And being freed from the surrealists allowed him to pursue new revenue incomes and make work that was no longer being shown in surrealist exhibitions. So he no longer had to be censored or, you know, neutered. So it gave him a certain degree of freedom, breaking away from the radical communists.
And he was pro-Hitler, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was pro-Hitler. He painted Hitler several times, and he talked about his fantasies. Because part of surrealism was you're supposed to open up your subconscious and examine your fantasies and your dreams and your fixations. And so he started, so like a fool, he started actually saying the things that he was dreaming about and the things he was thinking about. And some of those included Hitler and having sex with Hitler and watching, you know, and crazy, stupid stuff like that. And the communist surrealist said, no, I don't believe you dreamed that, comrade. No, I think you'll find you're in error. And he was like, you know, we don't talk about that. We don't do that.
That sounds like the average episode of this podcast.
Yeah, I was asking that person that said you didn't dream that sounds like the kind of Paul Taylor of them, the kind of Pablo, and not Spanish for Taylor, but you know what I mean. Like
you're the Dali of this group, Ed.
I'm the most creative and original and genius. Like, yeah,
I'm sick.
and sick. But there was that case, wasn't there? There's a picture that Dali did, a realistic picture, quite early, I guess, in his artistic career, as a naked 15-year-old boy that obviously fell asleep on a bed in his presence. So he just, what shall I do? I'll draw him, including everything, you know, including his bollocks, and in like graphic detail. So that was the kind of chap he was. So what are the going back to the contemporary situation? So we now have, for example, a bookshop in Suffolk that sells mainly based books.
Yes.
Yes. Should we plug it? What's the name?
Yes, we shall. We shall tell people about Old Speak Bookshop, run by Joe. So that's where I went to launch this book. Went there for a signing. And they do that. So they do a really nice. It's a place called Long Melford, which is not far from Sudbury. Sudbury is one of the larger villages, one of the small towns in Suffolk. You can get there by train.
There, they marry their second couples.
Well, that was. But they produced Gainsborough, so they must be doing something right, no matter who they're marrying. So Long Melford is the home of Old Speak Bookshop, which you can find just by sort of typing it in. And they do based books there. They do the Camus, they do the Renard, they do
Two left wing.
Yeah. and they do Alexander Adams. So there are signed copies of my book there. So if you want to support real dissident free speech, go there. And they have a big selection of books, and they're really great.
So that's what's happening in terms of books. But what's happening other than you in terms of art? In terms of art,
right? So what I can do is I can tell people that there will be a new exhibition of, well, I don't want to say dissident art, but art by people who are not in the mainstream. That including me and including Ferro, our friend Ferro, and Sam Wild, and a young Australian artist who's making his debut in Britain called Ryan Defern. And we will be exhibiting in London, in central London, from the 7th of October to the 12th of October. And I recommend people check that out because that will be great fun. We had a huge turnout for the last show that was actually...
On the 12th. I'm in England on the 12th. Where?
Whoa. Great. Well, I hope to see you there for the final day of the show. That would be terrific.
I've got an interview in the evening on Femoid, and so I've got a day free. So tell me afterwards where the show is.
Yeah, I will. It's very close to King's Cross. We're going to be announcing it, so people can find out where it is by going to cudo.gallery. So that's cudo.gallery. Go there, and all the information will be directed to your email inbox on the day of the opening. We're doing a big dramatic reveal.
I hope you're hearing this, all 2,136 of you. That's 2,136, Lipton.
Good.
Yeah.
And they're all smiling.
It's way more than we get on like The View. Lipton wants to go on The View, Alexander.
I should be on The View. I'm more qualified than Whoopi.
You're on
a whoopee cushion is more qualified than whoopee.
Yeah. I can't think of anything. But
if that was pun tennis, Ed, that was 6-0. 6-0.
Pun tennis on the old spectrum or whatever, you know, the blah, 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 whatever, you know, it would be I wouldn't be doing particularly well. So does your art movement, Alexander, have connections to other forms of art, such as poetry or novels? I mean, you yourself, I know you write poetry and novels, but do these things connect?
Yeah, yes. Well, the great thing is that we're getting an overlap. So last time we had the poet Columba wrote some poems in relation to our pictures on the walls, and Matthew Fall McKenzie illustrated the front cover of his poetry book, of Columba's poetry book. So we're having a dialogue. So the poets are getting illustrated. They're coming in and writing poems about the pictures, you know, we're talking to, you know, there's the base creates, so they're into drama. They do dramatic productions, so they could do staged readings of stuff. So we're looking to develop these things, and that's actually a chapter in the book. It's called Towards a Based Barbican. So, like, could you actually set up a based arts centre? And I look at the problems and the advantages of having something that will deal with drama and poetry, and it will do some publishing, it will have our art exhibitions and have musical performances.
Because the main thing we have at the moment, as far as I can see, that the sort of the HQ of this stuff is Imperium Press, which is based in Australia. And this has published various sort of conservative poets, conservative artists, conservative novelists. A conservative with a small C, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah. So they've published both of the books. And I would say the novel, for example, well, both books, I would say they're more reactionary than conservative. So I would say there's really deep old traditionalist stuff. There's some conservative stuff, but there's quite a lot of dissident and reactionary stuff that's not outright traditional. And you'll find a real range of views. And I think people will be surprised at how stimulating and broad their range is.
So what's the difference between reactionary and conservative? Is there more of a fury and anger in reactionary?
Possibly, but also you've got conservatives. I think something that I talk about in the new book is how conservatives often tie themselves to tradition in form rather than tradition in spirit. So they end up supporting the flag, waving the flag, even when the flag has been hijacked and redesignated a symbol of new inclusive Britain. So they've ended up holding up a flag that's saying, I'm new and inclusive, because they pledged their loyalty to the flag rather than thinking about, is there a way of transmitting and progressing the spirit without tying myself to the Tate Gallery or the Union Jack flag or forms that can be taken over and corrupted. We talk about the progressives making a skin suit of an institution like the church or a museum or a university and wearing the skin suit. So what's going on underneath is completely different. You're worshipping the university, but underneath it's a political organization designed to spread liberalism. It's not the university that you thought it was. It's not the museum. It's not.
So we should be into the modern equivalents of the Warrington Academy rather than Oxford University. You mean that sort of thing?
Alexander, so what's your problem with localism in art?
Okay, so I wrote an article. Very good. I wrote an article about the problem of localism. So the problem of localism is you're going to end up with a lot of stuff because people don't have very deep roots. I am as guilty of this as most people. I spent a lot of time abroad. I lived in Spain. I lived in Germany. I lived in Berlin for 7 years. So I am as not quite as rootless as they come, but I'm pretty rootless. So I know about this. And the problem of championing localism is you're just saying basically, well, what's the opposite of global art? Well, local art. So what's the central funding, central control? Oh, decentralized. So that means that leads you to localism. And that's great. But what's going to happen is because people don't have very deep roots, people are not terribly connected to the artistic tradition of where they come from. People are not certain of who they are. They've been weaned off it by education, by television, by international travel, by having a dispersed family. So they're not truly as rooted as they need to be for this localism to have meaning. So what's going to happen is they're going to start doing Victorian salon paintings, thinking, ooh, you know, it's a view of my local scene, so that must make it localism, right? Well, no, you know, you're actually just using an idiom you've borrowed to a local scene. It's not a real connection. So that's one of the problems we've got.
Or they might create a painting of us and call it localism because the Jolly Heretic has become essential to English culture.
That is true. That is undoubtedly and Finnish culture as well. Yeah. That is undoubtedly true. We have a question from Aldor Banner. Fenn de Villiers is a dissident futurism sculpture. Thank you very much.
Yes. So we know, we keep watching this space. There's going to be an announcement about Fenn de Villiers, who's a friend and colleague of mine, who I've a great deal of time and admiration for. Keep watching this space.
Isn't there a famous French politician called de Villiers?
Matt de Villiers was a tennis player, wasn't he?
Oh, there's Theresa Villiers. She was a Conservative cabinet minister.
That's
about it. And he's quite interesting, is he? This fellow de Villiers.
So he what he's doing is he does a sort of sculpture which is a sort of combination of sort of the heroism of classical sculpture, but then there's an element of futurism from the Italian futurists from the 1910s, and then there's also an aspect of Art Deco, which is really interesting. So that's a bit of the machine aesthetic. I would say definitely go and have a look at Fenn de Villiers. You can find him online, and you can also find him on social media.
Listen, ask a question. Solo is meowing at me. What do you want?
I asked three questions already.
Oh, Alex, while he's gone, are you familiar with the work of Michael Oakeshott, the English philosopher stroke historian?
I have heard the name. I can't say I'm familiar.
Catch you about him at some point, because he has a notion of the enterprise society versus the civil association. And he was an expert on Thomas Hobbes. And his basic argument was he's very pro-tradition. But he said an enterprise society is like an ideologically driven society that has an aim it's trying to achieve. Whereas a society that fosters tradition best is a society that allows the framework for civil association, and then people can make of their lives what they want. And it's much more sophisticated than that, but that's a rough idea.
Yeah, and that's a great point. We know that conservatives are often portrayed as being pro-market, but the problem with pro-market is it's the opposite of localism. Because capital is fugitive, because it's also international, it's national and it's also international, it is the sort of thing that will uproot you. It will also import things that are not native to your culture. So this is like the mechanism for tearing the heart out of localism. And that's why true localism is really difficult to do now, or the sort of localism you'll get is going to be a weird hybrid, which might be kind of exciting or interesting, or it could be kind of ghastly. So, if you've got capitalism, what it's doing is it's setting you up in enterprise, and it's kind of also forcing you. It could force you into these guild ideas, which is something that was developed by sort of Ruskin and Morris in the late 19th century. So you have this idea of reviving the guild, where master artists, master craftsmen would come together and work together on projects, and they would also sort of cross-support each other, as we've talked about in the sort of Based Barbican or Imperium Press even. But then there is... But then capitalism is also working against you, because it's going to pull you apart and atomize you. And
yeah, it's a slightly different point Oakeshott's talking there about. When he says enterprise society, he actually means enterprise as an ideological construct like the Soviet Union, having an enterprise that you want to achieve.
Oh, right. Yes, I see what you mean. Yes, so it's actually guided. It's a sort of top-down, or at least the idea is diffused. Yeah.
And it's very relevant to today, because we live in ideologically driven times, whereas his ideas are much more sophisticated than just anarcho-libertarianism. He's basically wanting a strong structure to enable people to be free and not to have any teleological or driven desires to create something specific. And if you're in a society where no specific ends are being sought ideologically, strikes me that's a society that artists could prosper in.
Possibly, but then you could also say a lot of the art of the Renaissance was specifically commissioned by the Medicis, who were the rulers of Florence, for example, So they were making art to glorify themselves and the state, because the Medici family and the state were one in the same thing. And so they were also encouraging them to link this back to the idea of Christian nobility and gallantry and honor and classical ideals of beauty and so forth. So it was all being fused together. And that's what makes the art of the Renaissance so magical when it is at its very best. And that is actually quite ideologically driven. So,
well, I dispute that in the sense that there's a massive theology that can be disagreed with from within, as opposed to truly, you know, boring, ideologically limited ways of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a difference between the Medicis and socialist realism of the Soviet Union. So, yeah, there's a spectrum. Yeah.
Alexander, is conservative art a genre or a style? If it's a style, it can evolve. If it's a genre, it's fixed. So a conservative is traditional. So that's what I mean. What is it a genre or a style?
Well, I mean, obviously it's a state of mind, but it is also a movement. It is also a style. So it's both things at once. So not to kind of get out of that, but it's both things at once. It's possible to take up a conservative style and do some subversive things with it. For example, like Stanley Spencer, early 20th century religious painter, would sort of fuse conservative approaches to art with his sort of radical, weird, freeform, evangelical approach to Christianity. So you have a peculiar hybrid. It's possible to take up conservative things and do odd things with them. Also, a painter like Lucian Freud is, theoretically, you look at his stuff and it looks quite conservative, but actually he's including all sorts of odd and perverse things. So he's not really conservative in attitude. So he's just conservative in treatment.
And Banksy, is Banksy a good artist?
No, I would say read my book called Artivism, and I explain why he's a lousy artist and he's a fake rebel, because he basically supports everything that the establishment supports, with the exception of possibly of Free Palestine.
I just like Beryl Cook, and I think Beryl Cook may have been influenced by Stanley Spencer. They have similar kind of semi-cartoonish styles.
Correct.
It's like Stanley Spencer, but it's take out all of the deep shit and just have fat
fat ladies laughing at funny shaped baguettes.
Yeah, just have that. No fucking about. Well, I'd like to thank Alexander for coming on. It's been an extremely interesting discussion, and I like the fact that more of you seem to like this bit of the discussion than discussing the mean police women 12-year-olds. And so please go over to buy How to Start an Art Movement by Alexander Adams. You'll find it on Amazon, or you can buy it from Imperium Press. And in general, and I'm biased because I've published a number of books with Imperium Press, Imperium Press is doing a jolly good job. You've got a number of books by me, for example, Woke Eugenics, How Social Justice Masks Social Darwinism, and whatever my one was on eugenics, Breeding the Human Herd, that's the fellow.
Yeah. You need to send me a PDF of Woke Eugenics so I can review it. I'm a really good reviewer, as you can see, with your book, The Genius. Not The Genius, yes. I mean.
Surely, didn't you review Sent Before Their Time?
Yeah, that's what I reviewed.
Yeah. I will do that. Okay. All right. So, I forgot to give you a copy in person, didn't I? All right. Well, thank you very much, chaps. Remember, Alexander's book, Amazon. We will see you all next week. And goodbye!
Goodbye.